All right, welcome to the Fit Vegan Podcast. I'm your show host, Maxim Seguin, and I'm the founder and CEO of Fit Vegan Coaching, a company that is on a mission to help 10,000 people get lean, thrive, and reduce their risk of chronic illnesses by 2033 and a million by 2050. I believe that having a fit, healthy body and mind is the foundation to living an incredible life, and this is what the show will give you if you choose to listen and implement. Enjoy the episode and have a great day. All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Fit Vegan Podcast. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Mr. Chuck Carroll, who's the host of the Physician Committee, his popular Exam Room podcast, which I had the opportunity to be on. He's known widely as the weight loss champion, which was given the name by an NFL player for losing an incredible 275 pounds. Chuck, welcome to the show, brother.
Oh, so good to be here, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm happy we're able to make it work. We have a busy schedule, so I'm very appreciative of your time. So let's just dive into it. What, my original question might sound deep, but like, what got you to the place where you weighed 400 plus pounds? Like, what led you to be to that place besides the obvious, which was eating not good food?
Yeah, but that is kind of a deep question, right? Because the easy answer is always going to be the food and the fact that I remember going to the drive-thru at a very young age. But the fact of the matter is, yes, there was food, but then there's the why there was that particular kind of food. I grew up with very humble beginnings, not a lot of money. And so being raised by a single mother and spending the afternoons at our grandma's house, my brother and I, who had even less money, we grew up eating what we could afford. And a lot of times that was, you know, the cheapest canned items off of the store shelves. It was deli meat sliced ultra thin. I mean, the cheapest ones that you could get for like 50 cents a pack of it. And it was so thin you could see, you know, you could read through it. And so lots of that, and macaroni and cheese and baked beans. And then when mom would pick us up, after she got through at work, you know, having eaten that macaroni and cheese and the baked beans and hot dogs and deli meats and things like that, on top of all of that, then we would go to the drive-thru and my appetite grew and grew. And so, in the third and fourth grade, I was already ordering adult-sized combo meals. At the time, Burger King was calling them king size. So I got the biggest fries and the biggest drink with a double cheeseburger, ketchup only, and thought that that was the bee's knees. And so my weight just grew and grew and grew and grew, even though, you know, I love sports. I was outside. I was active. But I was already over 100 pounds by the time I was in the third grade. I was, you know, maybe one of two kids in our class who was that heavy, and being mortified and even telling teachers and adults, like, I got to go on a diet at such a young age. And then the appetite grew over time because finances really didn't change much for very many years. And so just eating a lesser and lesser healthy diet and getting sicker and sicker as a result, the pounds just kept pouring on, man.
Yeah. It says a lot about the food system and kind of like what is accessible when you don't have enough funds. Like, I remember cutting slices of bread in half to just make the bread last longer. You know, you just want to be able to like not have to buy bread again. So how did you feel that that affected you kind of growing up in that environment from a psychological standpoint? Because especially when you grow up, you want to fit in to a certain extent, right? And how was that for you to trying to fit in, but kind of also experience this change in your body, I think earlier on than most people would?
I was embarrassed. I was mortified, but at the same time, I kind of just leaned into it. I remember growing up a huge baseball fan. Excuse me, my daggone wedding ring just popped off. Man, that would have been a bad day. So, and I guess, you know, I'm 30 pounds lighter now than when I got married. So I guess it's time to get it resized. Anyway, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. I remember just kind of leaning into the I'm a bigger guy persona. And my first love in sports was baseball. And there was a bigger baseball player by the name of Cecil Fielder. And his son also played in the majors years later. But he was a big guy. And I remember, you know, just thinking like, I'm going to be the Cecil Fielder of our team. And I remember being in high school and considering going out and playing baseball. And, you know, the catcher, who was a friend of mine, said, yeah, you'll be our Cecil Fielder. And I was like, yeah, I'll be your Cecil Fielder. That will be awesome. And then embracing the nickname that I was given by other classmates, Heavy C. And then, you know, when I got into professional wrestling, going under the moniker of Pound Sterling, for a little while, thank you. And then even as I got older and got into my professional broadcast career as well, you know, working at a radio station, WBIG were the call letters in Washington, D.C., and being Big Chuck. And so I kind of tricked myself and tried to trick others into believing that I needed to be that guy in order to succeed. And so that took a lot of the pressure off of me, at least subconsciously anyway, to make the changes that I so desperately needed to make for my health and, you know, my self-esteem, which I didn't really recognize to the full extent how much that was suffering at the time as well. But I think for myself and a lot of people who are in that super overweight category, that is, you know, you do take that Chris Farley type approach where you're the biggest person in the room with the biggest personality. And that way people will see past your big size and they just want to be around you because you're so damn lovable, you know?
Yeah. That's actually one thing I was going to ask is like, you basically tricked yourself into this new identity to justify that, like, this is who I am and I don't need to change anything. It's all perfect the way that it is right now. So when did that shift in identity start to happen? Because I'm going to assume that subconsciously, like you mentioned, it was, you knew what you were doing, but it just, I guess, felt so good. And it was just so much easier to kind of lean into it and to kind of make the changes. So when did that shift in identity kind of start to take place?
It was gradual and over time. I mean, I always tried to diet and I would lose weight and put it back on. I was just like everybody else, lose weight, put it back on, and then some, lose weight, put it back on, and then some. And I always felt really good when I would lose weight and the compliments were always fantastic.
Yeah.
But it would never stick. And so the health challenges just compounded as I got older. Now, mind you, I was really facing some pretty significant health challenges at an early age. Like I was missing very, very, very large chunks of school at a time. We're talking weeks, sometimes months at a clip through a combination of chronic illness and then chronic depression set in as well. My mental health was really tanking. And so I remember like I was a frequent flyer at the doctor's office, and before everything was computerized, they would, you know, carry in these files, you know, with all of your medical records. And man, that thing just got thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker over time. And they had this sheet of paper where they would just check off what that day's diagnosis was. And I always thought it would be like a game. Can I get every diagnosis that's on that sheet humanly possible? But my blood pressure, man, it was out of control. Like sophomore, freshman, even in high school, it was like 180, 190 over 100 or 110. And they put me on beta blockers. And that really didn't do much to change my mentality in terms of needing to eat healthier, because I just assumed I've got these pills, I'm good to go. So I went to the pharmacy to fill the prescription. And while the prescription was being filled, I would go to the drive-thru and then back, you know, to get up the pills that that would bring the blood pressure back down. It's crazy, man.
Yeah. So you'll consume the poison before, well, the medicine, which so be poisoned to a certain extent, but you know, obviously you would fulfill the bad habit. So did you have any siblings growing up?
Yeah, one brother, older brother, Richard, a couple years older than I am.
And did he kind of go through a similar journey as you throughout, as you kind of, because usually if our family, we were into fitness, so undoubtedly our whole family kind of fell into fitness. I have friends that their family tend to be a little bit more overweight, and then kind of everyone in the family ended up heading in that direction. Like did your brother kind of end up in the same path as you, and kind of how was that like to kind of navigate that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, his story to tell, but yeah, I will say as a family, by and large, we all have struggled with our weight. And certainly we all grew up eating the same things. And so naturally, if you're in that same environment, you're eating the same diet, just as you were talking about with members of your own family, you can go one route or the other. If everybody's fit, or if, you know, the leaders are fit, then odds are, you know, everybody else in that family is going to be fit as well. And so for us, unfortunately, the opposite was true, where, you know, everybody was eating an unhealthy diet, not really active. And so the weight would come, you know, come on. And so we all kind of went up and down the scale at times, but by far and away, I had the most severe struggle. Like it wasn't even close. My brother never struggled to the extent that I did. And so even though, as I said, everybody had their own struggle, I was the leader in the clubhouse, my man. Yeah. By a good 100, 150, maybe even 200 pounds.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier you did a lot of diets and to kind of, you lost the weight and kind of you put it back on. Why do you think that it didn't work originally? And what was your mentality getting into those journeys of, let's just be honest, quick fat loss? Like, what was your mentality going into those? Was it just like, I just need to drop it and then I'm good? Or was it like, hey, I'm doing this so that I can do this forever after?
Drop it and I'm good. There was no long term. It was just get the weight off as quickly as possible. And I don't think that, you know, keeping the weight off long term was anything that really entered my mind until years later. I don't think the majority of people actually look at it that way. It's just lose weight, lose weight, lose weight. I think that's why when you know, see online or in the reels or the TikToks or whatever, like you look at these things and it's just, you know, so-and-so lost 100 pounds. And it's all a very recent weight loss story. Very rarely do you hear the stories of so-and-so lost it and has kept it off for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, right? Those stories are few and far between, not just because of the fact that, you know, when you look at the diet, you have to analyze, is this attainable long-term? It's just clearly we have blinders on to it. We have a goal set in our mind to lose this amount of weight by this specific day for this specific reason. It could be, if you're a woman, fitting into a dress for a special occasion. That's wonderful, right? But as soon as that day passes, you've achieved your goal. What do? You reward yourself with the very foods that you have been avoiding. And for me, that's when food addiction enters into the conversation. And I think that for a lot of us, that's a real slippery slope as well, and not anything that we view consciously at all. I don't think a lot of people realize that, you know, a donut can be as addictive as cocaine. You know what I mean? But when we look at food in those terms, that will completely turn the tables on how you're looking at both short and long-term diets.
Yeah. Let's talk about food addiction. But you mentioned something interesting. You know, there's that reward pattern when something exciting happens. It's a wedding, it's a birthday celebration, you got a promotion at work, whatever. The reward is always to go towards an unhealthy behavior. Let's go drink, let's go eat junk food, let's go order pizza. There's never of like, hey, let's just go for a hike and have a green juice after. It's always like going for some of those processed food. Did that play kind of a role in your journey? Did you kind of notice that was a pattern? It was like, hey, we did good. We lost 10 pounds. Let's go reward ourselves. Or there's this beautiful thing that happened in my life. Let's just go to McDonald's and order a burger.
100%, man. 100%. That was always the goal. I'm going to lose, you know, for every 5 pounds, I'm going to reward myself with a trip to the drive-thru or something along those lines, right? But then you brought up, you know, drinking and going to the bar to celebrate like that. Well, if instead you're looking at addiction in terms of alcoholism, you wouldn't say, well, I'm going to celebrate a week of sobriety by having a beer, right?
Yeah, that's exactly.
You and I both know that anyone who sets out to stop drinking, who says, well, if I can limit myself to one drink a week, I'll be okay, that's not really going to end all that well. And yet, if we look back at all of the, quote, failed diets that we've been on, they operate in much the same fashion. You can trace back the beginning of the downfall of the diet to the time that you've rewarded yourself with that chocolate cake or that piece of pizza or the trip to the drive-thru, whatever the case may be, ice cream. It really doesn't matter. You know what your vice is. And what happens is, just like with that one drink becomes a second and a third. And before you know it, all of the wheels have fallen off the wagon and you are starting at ground zero once again. If not, you've dug in yourself an even deeper hole and you're heavier than you've ever been in your entire life. It is a sick cycle that we find ourselves in.
Yeah. So do you think that that's kind of what happened to you, is you would kind of go for, that sprint of weight loss, and then would kind of fall in the rewarding pattern, and it would set you back a little bit further than you originally started, and then you would go at it again and then revert back a little bit further than you were before, and then ultimately just led you to go up to 400 plus pounds?
100%. And I will give you two very specific examples that were very profound. The first is what I call my one nacho theory. And this was, I had actually lost 60 pounds at this point, going on one of those gimmick diets that somebody had brought into my mom's gym. And it came with a lot of pre-prepared foods. It wasn't one of the big name diets, but it was, you know, like pre-prepared meals that didn't even need to be refrigerated. So that tells you how healthy they were. but I had lost like 60 pounds doing that. And thought, and I was working at a Mexican restaurant at the time and had resisted temptation for so long. But then like one day was like, oh man, you know, I bet I can have just a nacho and I'll be okay. Well, that one nacho became a second and a third and a fourth. And then I was dunking it in the nacho cheese. And before you know it, I was rolling my own burritos and then back at the drive-thru at Taco Bell. And all of that weight that I had lost, all of that hard work, that 60 pounds, that came back within a matter of months. And then 20 plus on top of that. Flash forward a couple of years, I'm working in radio, WBIG, shout out to Big 100.3 in Washington, D.C. And they approached me to endorse something called the cookie diet. And at this point, I was pretty close to the heaviest I had ever been in my entire life. And the cookie diet is you eat a cookie for breakfast, you drink a lot of water with it. It's supposed to fill you up and hold you over to lunch. Same deal at lunch. Eat the cookie, drink a lot of water, hold you over to dinner. And at dinner, you eat something what they call a sensible dinner. And they never tell you what that really means. Just make sure that there are vegetables on your plate.
Cool. Just to confirm, like an Oreo cookie or is it like a special cookie that they made?
And I wish it was an Oreo cookie. This thing was like the worst tasting cookie in the history of cookies. It wouldn't even qualify as a cookie in most people's book. This was like a spongy-like cookie substance that if you were lucky, you got a hint of cinnamon, and on a really good day, there was a raisin in there. Other than that, this cookie tasted like poo. And so like that in itself wasn't really appetizing at all. But, you know, because I was being paid to endorse this thing, because I was being paid to lose weight and talk about it on the radio, I wanted to be a good boy. And so the first day I was really motivated and I did okay, right? The cravings were there. But then the second day, here's where the changes started to set in. I started, one, to feel a little bit sick, like I was coming down with something. Didn't think much of it at the time. But I was also a little bit more irritable and cranky and really, you know, kind of wanted, I was missing my Taco Bell because that was my go-to more than anything else.
Yeah.
And so day three comes and I'm able to, you know, push past the cravings until day three when all hell breaks loose. And my brain just like freaks out because I have not had Taco Bell. Literally, my only thought that day was Taco Bell and getting my daily fix. And I had been on a first name basis with the people at the drive-thru. They knew my order as soon as my car pulled into the parking lot. And so I'm like 48 hours removed from eating this and I'm freaking out and I'm feeling sicker and sicker and sicker as the day wears on. And I had gotten to a point where I'm so agitated because all I could think about was Taco Bell that you could have said, it's a glorious day, man. Thank you so very much. It's a pleasure to work with you. So great to see you. And I would have wanted to rip your head off. You know, you could have been the nicest person in the world, but because you weren't Taco Bell, I had no time for you. I had no time for you. So I make it all the way to that night. I go home. I'm feeling like full-blown sick. I'm laying in bed. I got the covers pulled up over me. And then I just spring out of bed because I couldn't take it anymore. And I actually punch my fist through a wall because I hadn't gotten my Taco Bell fix. And then when that didn't calm me down, I punched my fist through a door. That didn't calm me down either. And so I devised this plan to sneak out at the middle of the night, go to the 24-hour drive-thru, and load up. And this was both the best thing and worst thing to ever happen to me. The worst thing because it kind of derailed the cookie diet, but it was the best thing because it changed my life at the same time because of the revelation that it provided to me. Because as soon as I did this and I took that first bite of the 7-layer burrito, all of that anger, that sickness, the anxiety, the depression, it went away instantaneously. And it was replaced by like this euphoric feeling. It was like I was living in utopia. It was beautiful. I was so happy. But then I was also aware enough to realize that, holy crap, this is what everybody talks about when they relapse with addiction. It's like you feel so much better, but then you have this realization that you're sick and this is what you need to survive, or what you think you need to survive. And that's the only way you're going to feel better. And so that happiness was replaced by a deep sorrow. And I sat there and I ate that entire 4,500 calorie order, which was my standing order, was 4,500 calories from Taco Bell. And I just wept because I was out of control. And even though I knew that I was destined for an early grave because I was pushing close to 400 pounds at that point, this was what I needed at that moment to survive. And so as I'm endorsing this cookie diet, I had these secret midnight missions to Taco Bell, and I would just spend three and a half hours in the gym to burn it all off. Because when you're that size, you're burning calories pretty rapidly. It's a little bit easier to do, even if it's a super calorie load. And so that was my secret thing. And I would just go on the air and say, the cookie diet is great. Look at me. I've lost all this weight. It's like BS. I'm at the gym busting my hump just so I can support my habit.
That's crazy. I would probably feel sick on cardboard cookies too. But ultimately, it was a cardboard cookie. It was the detoxification, right? Yeah. Of you not eating these processed foods. That's crazy. So, you know, I was obviously doing a little bit more research as we kind of recorded this podcast. I read somewhere that you were consuming at one point like 10,000 calories a day. Was that around that time?
Yeah, that was right around it. You know, whether it was 18 to 24 inches of Subway that I would have for lunch, or the two pizzas I would have for dinner before I would go to Taco Bell, or the taquitos, six of them, and two big bottles of Gatorade I would get at 7-Eleven. Oftentimes, I would go to Boston Market and get a family meal just for myself, you know, eat half of an entire chicken plus the three large sides. I thought that was healthy because it's just chicken, right? How bad could it possibly be for me, especially if I'm drinking diet lemonade with it? It's a healthy meal. But then the psychology of somebody who's wrapped up into food addiction is amazing. It is amazing. Yeah. I wish I could go back in time and have a conversation with myself. And so I never looked at my caloric or fat intake at that time. I certainly wasn't using anything like Chronometer at that point in my life. And so when I actually went back after the fact and tallied everything up and saw that it was like 10,000 calories, I was like, holy crap. No wonder I couldn't walk more than 10 feet without feeling like I was going to have a heart attack. And that's a legitimate thing. Like I was becoming immobile because my heart felt like it was going to give out, but I couldn't help myself.
Which not to put a positive twist on it, but it's impressive because I'm sure you saw on YouTube people trying to do a 10,000 calorie day as a challenge and a lot of time fail at it because it's just so much food that you can consume. So your stomach definitely got used to kind of the quantity and the volume of food that you were eating. So was there any vegetables in there, or was it just like you were eating some from time to time, or there's just like no conscious awareness of like fruits or veggies at the time? Is that how Taco Bell's have like behind like the iceberg lettuce that's probably in a burrito or something? I think that's pretty much it.
Well, don't forget the tomatoes that they put in there too. Not really on my radar, except for the toppings if I were to go to Subway on the sub. But they were not the foremost thought at all. But I will say I made a conscious effort to always get the cream spinach as well at Boston Market. So maybe there was that, but nothing like I was eating today. I mean, thinking back as a kid, my mom would try every now and again, but it just wasn't happening. You got to remember, like growing up for me, the idea of a vegetable was like baked beans out of a can with a lot of sugar and little chunks of pork fat in there. So that was a vegetable, my friend.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like you mentioned, a self-justification process as you're kind of eating these foods. I had someone tell me they're eating spinach chips. But I'm like, they're just chips with like a bit of spinach powder in there. Like it's not spinach as a whole. It's a chip with some spinach in there. So do you remember, like, was there any milestones as you were kind of putting on weight that you're like, man, life is different now at this weight? And then there was there another milestone you're like, not life is now, this changes at this weight. Was there like any of those moments where you just consciously were made aware of like, oh shit, I can't do this anymore, or oh, those things that I really like to do, I can't do?
Yeah. I remember in high school, that's a great question. Nobody's ever asked me that. That is a good question, my friend.
Thank you.
In high school, we took a senior class trip to Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida, which for any high school out there, unless you have a marching band that is performing in a parade, I will tell you it is a horrible idea to let the students run free in an amusement park. But that's a podcast for another day. Anyway, my friends and I decided to go on the Incredible Hulk roller coaster, and we all loaded in. I couldn't lower the seat fit me properly, and I had to get up and then actually go and sit in another roller coaster seat that was like four rows in front, that was specifically designed for larger people, others who needed a little extra room because they were well endowed in the chest. Literally, it said that on the sign. And so that was mortifying, to hold up an entire production for hundreds of people because of my size, just so we could go. And I remember, like, my first thought was, I'm so embarrassed. I was like, just send the ride and I'll hold on for dear life. I don't want to be singled out here because of my size. Of course, that would have resulted in death and disaster. So I'm glad that they actually made me switch seats, but that was mortifying, man. That was mortifying.
And that was, how old were you at that time?
16, maybe 17.
Yeah.
So already too big to fit into a roller coaster. And then really in my early 20s, though, in terms of health, just not being able to walk that 10 feet and knowing that my grandfather had died of a heart attack, a number of them before one finally killed him, but had died from a heart attack before I was even born. And my other grandfather on my mother's side, who had had quadruple bypass after having a number of heart attacks, and my own father, who had had heart troubles. And I was just really on that accelerated plan. I knew exactly what was happening with this chest pain and inability to breathe, and being that heavy, you know, at only 5'5" and 420 pounds, a 66-inch waist, like, of course, you're like super morbidly obese. My BMI was close to 70. And I was going to die, man. And so, like, that puts the fright into you, not being able to fit onto an airline seat. Actually, yeah, that's another similar story, man. Just like praying leading up to the day. I hadn't flown in many years since I was a little kid. And then knowing how small these airplane seats could be, just praying that I would fit into it. Clearly, that was not in God's plans that day. So having to get up from that seat and then ask for a seatbelt extender so we could take off. But then, like, seeing the eyes of judgment cast upon you with every row that you would pass, and people also talking to God, but, you know, thanking him because this big guy wasn't sitting next to them for this entire flight, spilling over into their seat. You know, like, that's embarrassing. And you know, like, it just takes a toll on you, man. It mentally, physically, every way possible. And you just get worn down over the years. And I don't think there's ever this one incident in particular for most people that's like, that's it. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. No, it's like, it's just, you can't take the shit anymore. Excuse my language.
Yeah, that's all right. I swear all the time on a podcast. It's okay. But yeah, so I guess that accumulation over the years, and I guess you don't, I've never experienced that level. I think the highest I went was 240 pounds, which is like 60 plus than I am now. But yeah, you just don't think that these things would be something that you would have to worry about when you book a flight, or when you go to a roller coaster, or you go on trip with friends. Was there, like, how can I say this? How was it with your mom, kind of as you were going through that and as you started to kind of transform positively? Like, we didn't dive into that side yet of, like, you going plant-based and all that, like, but how was it with kind of your mom and your family as you were nearing up to that 400 plus pounds, and that you're like, I need to change something? Because people think that it's just me, but a lot of times the people that we love around us that are affected by that.
You know, it's funny, I'm sure that there was a great deal of concern, but the biggest concern that I recall getting was actually from friends and not family. And that came after the cookie diet failed. You know, once the endorsement stopped, I, you know, couldn't care less about going to the gym or eating those cookies. So the normal menu came back. I wasn't burning any calories at the gym. So the weight just flew right back on. They became so concerned for me. They tried to organize an intervention. And I got wind of it ahead of time, wanted nothing to do with it, read this guy, the Riot Act, who was organizing it, who, by the way, I owe virtually my entire radio career to behind the mic because he gave me my big break, and cut him out of my life for a number of years, along with some other friends, because they were still trying to stand in the way of me and the thing that at that point in my life, I cared the most about. And that was still Taco Bell. And so, you know, who were they to tell me that I can't have what is most important to me? And I wasn't ready to change. So the biggest level of concern came from outside the family, but that's not to say that there wasn't concern there. I mean, mom, obviously growing up, took me to the doctors more times than I can remember, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. And especially you get to a point where you feel like it's more sensitive. I feel like family members sometimes will say less because they just love you and they just want to kind of be there for you and not have to cause confrontation sometimes.
Yeah.
So I'm asking this question again. You don't have to answer it. I'm just, like I mentioned before we started recording, and for the people listening, like, it's one thing to talk about gaining the weight and kind of losing it. Everyone goes like, oh yeah, if you eat more junk food and you don't exercise, this will happen. But I want people to understand like the pain and the challenges that happen when you go through this process. So hopefully it clicks in someone's brain that's on the way to there. If we can stop them 3/4 of the way, halfway through, or 1/4 of the way to be like, no, I need to change something. So for me, at least when I had a bad relationship with food, and I was binge eating, there was a form of escapism from there. So for you, yes, there's food addiction, but was there an aspect of escapism to the food and what were you potentially running away from? Or again, or maybe it's not a part of the story, but I'm just curious because that's what it was for me.
I mean, of course there's stuff there. I mean, being depressed for so long, you know, being put on antidepressants in the 6th grade, there's always depression. So I was just trying to have a little slice of happiness where I could find it. And so I think, you know, there was part of that there. Obviously, growing up in a single parent house, parents divorced when I was like little less than 2 years old. You know, why are my friends' parents married and mine aren't? I don't know. You know, why did grandma have to die, who was like the most influential person in my life, you know, in terms of raising me and shaping me into become the person who I am today? There's a lot that goes into there. I mean, you know, having a babysitter, an incident that was less than pleasant, you know, where they got extremely inappropriate, and I didn't realize until I was much older how heavy of a toll that actually took on me. I guess I kind of suppressed it, you know, and maybe that will have factored into it. But, you know, by and large, like, I don't like to blame emotions and escapism too much for anything, because I do believe, and this is an ultra simplistic view, but I do believe that if you're conscious of the decision that you're making and the potential ramifications, you're smart enough to know that there is the possibility for change. And so it's just a matter of reaching whatever rock bottom might be for you, and then using that rock bottom, not just to sink and stay, but then to catapult, to launch, to, you know, just spring out of there into a new and healthier life. And so when you reach that rock bottom, you just kind of recognize it and you catapult forward. And so, yeah, long answer to a short question. There probably was a sense of escapism. But, you know, I think that the more important thing is not to settle into a woe is me thing, because if you had something traumatic happen to you, like the babysitter incident, or, you know, painful separations or whatever the case may be, that wasn't entirely your fault. One thing that you absolutely can control is what you put in your body. And I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, but take all of that anger and that frustration and that rage that you have because you were never able to control that, and then put it into this and taking care of yourself and recognizing and giving yourself permission to be in control for perhaps the first time in your life. And you seize that control and you put all of your effort and energy into that. That is your sole focus. And that's when amazing things can happen. That's when amazing things can happen. So if you recognize that you're hurting, you're smart enough to know that you can change and fix the situation no matter how much. And I will tell you flat out, it will suck and it will be painful at first to make those changes. But when you break through and you prove to yourself how powerful you can actually be, brother, you got a sweet life ahead of you at that point.
Yeah. It sounds like this new belief was constructed as you were conquering the weight or after you conquered the weight. Was this belief that you had that if you're aware enough to notice the bad pattern, ultimately, that you have the power to change it, was that there before? Or was that there, did you construct that as you became the new Chuck Carroll?
It was there before. I just didn't recognize to the extent. I'd always been an ambitious guy. You know, had always wanted to work in radio or in media. And, you know, how many people, you know, don't pursue what their childhood dream was? They don't even bother pursuing it because they think it's never attainable. I've always been the kind of guy who feels like, well, if I want to do something, I'm going to do it. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, cool. That's fine too, right? That's always kind of been my inherent mentality. But what I've discovered is that everybody has that same opportunity. And I don't care if you're a man, woman, non-binary, black, Hispanic, white, Asian, it does not matter who you are or where you have come from. If you have the drive to do something, you absolutely can do it. Why? Because people before you have already proven time and again that it can be done. I'm not saying everybody's going to win the Super Bowl. I'm not saying everybody's going to win the lottery. But by God, if your goal is to finish your education and become a teacher, there is absolutely nothing standing in your way of doing that. If your goal is to finish your education, become a doctor, there is absolutely nothing standing in your way of doing that. Pursue your dreams. Prove to yourself that you're worthy of it, for God's sakes, and amazing things can happen.
Yeah, I feel like it ties in a bit of the victim mentality that prevents people from moving forward. You know, one thing I always, at least that's how I, a belief that I have, that if there's something that I want to accomplish, there's someone out there in the world that has it worse than I have and is creating more beautiful things than I am.
Damn right.
And so it's just like, if they can do it, I can do it.
Right. And then, things like that don't happen for people like me. Okay. Well, let's add one word to it. How much does this change the phrase? Things like that don't happen to people like me yet. Yeah. Yet. And so that leaves the door open for you to kick that son of a bitch down and walk into the dreams that you so richly desire. Just add that to the end of that phrase. And I promise you that opportunity is always there.
Talking about dreams, I think you slightly mentioned it earlier. Do you say the pro wrestling?
Yes, sir. It was either going to be pro baseball or pro wrestling.
How did that come about? I would love to hear about that because I didn't know that.
A huge WWE and WCW fan. I can take it back, talk ECW, you know, NWO, all that good fun stuff. But so it was kind of taboo in my house for me to watch wrestling growing up. My mom didn't like it. She didn't understand it. So she's like, Richard's my brother. You guys can't watch this. And Richard never cared for it. So no big deal. But you tell me like something's off limits and I already kind of like it. Like I'm really going to like it. Now.
Yeah.
And so every opportunity I got to sneak in, you know, Saturday morning WWF Superstars or grandma had cable. So watching WCW Saturday night there and then later Nitro and Monday Night Raw growing up. I loved it. I loved the storytelling, just the over the top stupid. Yeah, I recognize that a lot of times. Stupid theatrics. But you know what? It's still a fun story and the action you just can't, you know, beat. And so I just kind of fell in love with the showmanship of the business. And so when I was still in high school, I went and I, you know, trained to become a referee and an announcer, learned a little bit about wrestling and, you know, wound up, you know, touring up and down the East Coast, the Mid-Atlantic region a little bit for a while and met some really interesting people. And eventually it was, in fact, a professional wrestler from WWE who convinced me to go turned to a plant-based diet, and that ultimately changed my life and set me on the path here where you and I are sitting down together today.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, first of all, I didn't know you did that. That's awesome. It just sounds like a great life experience to have. It seems like you pursued the things that, that you wanted, which a lot of people don't do. So yeah, let's talk about that transition to plant-based eating. Did it come before your, I'm gonna say your last successful transformation that got you to kind of where you are? Was it a part of the process? Did it happen before you started that process? Where did it kind of fall?
So it actually came after I had bariatric surgery. And I had the bariatric surgery as a last ditch effort to, at the time, I thought, save my life. 27 years old. This literally came just days after my 27th birthday. I had the surgery because at that point, my health was the worst it had ever been. Having to use a CPAP machine, high blood pressure medication, still way out of control, always sick, couldn't walk. Like just could not function, 420 pounds, putting on weight at such a fast rate that within a year, I would have been too big for the big and tall catalog, right?
Yeah.
And so like that's a scary proposition to be. One, you're going to be housebound, but even if you are, you're going to be dead in a couple of years anyway. And so I didn't want that. Like there were still a lot of things that I wanted to do. I still had a lot of ambition and I wasn't going to be able to accomplish that if I was going to be dead by the time I was 30. So I go through with the weight loss surgery thinking that, okay, well, most people who get this have success for a year, year and a half, 2 years tops, and then they start to put the weight back on. And I thought, well, this will buy me time until I'm 40. And at least at that point, I can say I went to my grave having tried everything. And so the funny thing that happened was when I woke up and I thought back from the surgery, I had this epiphany and I thought back to that night where I fell off the wagon on the cookie diet and realized that I was in fact addicted to food. Well, why in the world would I go back to eating all of that garbage when I had to go and do something as radical as literally undergo a procedure just to lose weight? Like that's just asinine to me. And so that the golden arches lost all of their shine, full of tarnish to me at that point. Taco Bell was, went from being my best friend to my mortal enemy, all the fast food. And I never had fast food again after that, because I knew that if I reintroduced that to my system, it would be no different than that one nacho theory where you think you can have it just once. It's like they can rewire your guts, man, but they can't rewire your brain. Yeah. And so I wasn't going to reintroduce that stuff. So I lose, a good amount of weight, but then the scale did still, in fact, start creeping up higher. One, because of a really bad relationship, man, even after you lose weight, like a really bad relationship. And so the scale starts creeping back up and I start playing mind games with myself. I was like, well, all right, if I get back up to 200 pounds, I'm still in better shape than I was. That's way better than 420. I'm good to go. Scale gets a little bit higher, never quite get to 200, but I'm thinking like, all right, well, when I get to 200, I can probably go 210, 220, I'll be okay. And I'm already like giving myself permission to go down this unhealthy road. And meanwhile, you know, I'm living my dreams. I'm covering the NFL. I'm working as a news reporter for CBS. I'm like meeting some really incredible people. I'm interviewing people of all walks of life, real big dignitaries. And then on the side for CBS, I had this pro wrestling column. And one day I'm interviewing a wrestler by the name of Austin Aries, who had just released a book called My Plant Powered Journey through Bingo Halls to the Big Time or something along those lines. And he's like, Chuck, I know that you're a big weight loss guy and you should really look into a plant-based diet. I was like, all right, well, let me take a look at this. And I did. And the more I investigated, the more I watched, the more I read, the more I realized like, holy Nikes, this isn't just going to solve my weight loss problem. This is going to check off the boxes for cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's and all kinds of other chronic illnesses that run, unfortunately, in my family, just like so many others. And what was a weight loss journey suddenly became just an overall health journey to see how far I could take this thing. And so without that interview with Austin that one day, I don't know what in the world would have happened, but you and I wouldn't be talking today. And I probably would have gotten back up to 240, 250. Who knows how high I would have gone, you know, maybe even back to the drive-through at some point.
That's interesting. So basically, when you did the surgery, you were just trying to buy yourself another decade to try to get more things done. It wasn't like, hey, let me just try to live to like 80 or 90. It was like, let me just buy another decade.
No.
So you had never had, have you heard of plant-based eating before that point? Or is that literally like your first introduction to like, let me just eat vegetables?
Dude, the only thing I knew about vegans at that point was that they were hippies. And that was all I knew. It was like, vegans are all hippies. They all hug trees and all they do is eat salad and, you know, do wheatgrass shots. And that was all I knew. And then when I realized, I was like, that's not true at all. Like, that's some nonsense stigma right there. Let me look up. Holy crap. I can eat muffins. I can eat cereal. Like, growing up in the South, I loved grits. Grits, obviously vegan. Like, you just don't cook them with milk. Like, I can do all that. And wow. You can do vegan versions of this, vegan versions of that. And then like another step further, like whole food plant-based and still nail the flavors of everything that you've always enjoyed your entire life. And make no mistake about it, my palate loves food as much at 140 pounds as it did at 420 pounds. The tongue is the same, my friend. All right. So I know good food when I taste it. And by God, if somebody who has ever been over 400 pounds tells you something is going to taste good, listen to them. You will never find bigger credibility than a big person or a former big person telling you that something tastes good. You can take that to the bank all day, Jack.
Yeah. So how many years ago was it that you made that transition?
Gosh. So what are we on? Season 7 of the... So yeah, we're like 8 years in now and going strong and have no reservations about sticking with it for the rest of my life. The results obviously have just been extraordinary and fantastic. And, you know, to see the positivity in this community and to help others along the way as well, have those same kinds of realizations, it just motivates me to keep going. And as you said, like, there were no visions of living to be 80 or 90 previously, but now, like, I want to hit 100. I want to be sitting out on my front porch holding my wife's hand, eating pineapple or watermelon on a warm summer's night, watching the sunset. You know, that's what I want. That's what I want. And it seems realistic now to me as opposed to 40 and then check out.
Yeah. Or just the hope that you can add another decade at that point.
That's it, man.
Was there any milestone as you kind of lost the weight that you're like, you know, as you went from, it's a significant difference in size. Cause obviously, you know, you're famous for your photos where you're holding your jeans. Right. So obviously as you went from those jeans to where you are today, was there any milestones? You're like, oh shit, whatever. I noticed this part of my body, or I fit in this now, or, you know, I can do this activity.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, I learned that when I got back on a roller coaster and was able to fit comfortably in the seat, that I'm very prone to motion sickness. So that wasn't as much fun as I thought it was going to be. But really, I think the biggest thing for me was just being able to buy clothes off the rack, which is such a simple thing. But my God, man, after having to shop in a big and tall catalog for years and then having to get everything custom hemmed and trimmed and this and that just to make it fit right, like, it was so refreshing. And then to have the opportunity to find things with color, you know, purple tie, you know, gray jacket with a pop of purple here, pink shirt, you know, as opposed to just the black, brown, and beige that was available to you when you were overweight. Like, this is great. And so I've really embraced color and wardrobe. And so that, you know, kind of morphing into a little bit more of a fashionable male, so to speak, has
so you're really sharply dressed. Every time I see you,
I feel overdressed for today. But it's perfect. I mean, I just love it because it, you know, it matches my personality. It's not that I necessarily crave attention. I just want people to know that I'm happy. That's it. Yeah. You know, and I think that colors, by and large, bright, beautiful colors make people feel happy as well. And so when, you know, they see them, they put a smile, they get a smile on their face. And so just to be able to provide just a little slice of heaven on an otherwise dull day for somebody makes me happy too. So that's kind of why I wear this. It's as much for everyone else's smile as it is for my own.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And so what does life look like now? What are you, obviously you know kind of what you were eating before, but what does a day of eating look like now? What does your exercise routine look like now?
Well, all right. Ye who just came back from the gym ain't going to like this answer. but I've, so as much as I like sports and stuff, like I've never been a huge gym guy. And so this is something that it stuns a lot of people when I say that I've really just walked my weight off and I stay consistent with that today and make sure that you get in your minimum 10,000 steps a day and do the things that you dismiss when you're overweight, thinking that they could never make a difference, like take the stairs instead of the elevator or park, you know, in the last spot in the parking lot and then walk into the store. Like one,
my wife doesn't like that one. She's like, I got high heels on. I was like, I'll drop you off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Well, number one, you're far less likely to get a dent or a ding in your car because nobody's going to be parking around you. But two, you're not fighting for a parking space, for God's sakes. There's plenty of parking back there. Like, what's the point? You circle around for 10 minutes trying to find the spot when you could have parked 10 minutes ago and walked your happy behind into the store. But all of that stuff adds up over the course of the day. And the best example I give of that was when I was working as a reporter at CBS, you know, the days that I would actually have to report to the station, if I was assigned there for the whole week, you know, I would park in that last spot. And over the course of the week, you know, it would be an extra mile I was walking just by parking in the back of the lot. And you say, well, 1 mile's not going to make much of a difference. Well, it does. But then think about it also in the bigger picture. You know, if you do that every week, say, you know, you use all of your time off. So say you're in the office maybe 48 of the 52 weeks out of the year. That's 48 miles that you're walking that you otherwise wouldn't have, that takes little to no effort. And I don't know anybody on the face of the earth who would say walking 48 miles isn't going to burn any calories or isn't good for me. Yeah, of course it is. It's a tremendous feat. And then when you add on top of that, the stairs instead of the elevator, you know, things like that, that all adds up in the same way so that, you know, you're giving your body the movement that it needs to be healthy without having to drag yourself to the gym at the end of the day if you're already tired. Now, if you're a gym guy, do you, but don't do something that you're not. You know, that's like saying the only way to be healthy is to eat onions. Well, I don't like onions. So guess who doesn't eat onions? This guy right here. If somebody told me that the only way to be plant-based was to eat onions, I'd be at, you know, Cracker Barrel pounding country fried steak right now. Yeah. But do what works for you. That's what works for me. So find what works for you and be honest with yourself about it.
Yeah. And walking burns more calories than actually going to the gym, right? The gym, like an exercise training session is only 5% of your total caloric burn for the day. Moving, walking, standing, kind of jittering around throughout the day is like 15 to 35% of your calories burned for the day. So it's a lot more than the gym. The gym is the smallest one. You burn more calories digesting food than you do during an actual workout session. So it's just, it's just there to burn to build muscle ultimately. So yeah. So in terms of like nutrition now, what does that look like? What was that? What was a breakfast and a lunch and a dinner before? And what is a breakfast, a lunch and a dinner now?
Big Chuck never ate breakfast, man. I was not a breakfast guy. I thought I would just save those calories. And so lunch would be, you know, toward the end, it was usually the Boston Market. So the half of the chicken with the three large sides and the diet lemonade. Then the six taquitos and two big bottles of Gatorade from 7-Eleven. Go home, order up five pizzas. We would get coupons in the mail. So it's like buy four, get a fifth free. Always do that. Eat one and a half or two of those. And then a few hours later, go to Taco Bell. And so like over the course of the day, that's how I got up to 10,000 calories a day because it was nothing but junk and fast food.
Yeah.
And then today, much different. Never miss an opportunity to eat breakfast. I love breakfast. I'm one of those, you know, oatmeal vegans. Love me some overnight oats. Get that going with some fruit, whether it's berries and pineapple. I love pineapple so much. So pineapples, blueberries, strawberries with the oatmeal for breakfast, glass of almond milk. I was a huge dairy guy too. I was drinking like a gallon of milk a day before I went vegan. And now it's a lot of almond milk or whatever, unsweetened. And I think it's just delicious. And so then for lunch, it's like, you know, like, well, let's put together a quick little bowl, you know, whether it's beans and rice with some vegetables on the side. And that can vary. It's kind of like what's in season, what do I have in the freezer, what have I cooked? And then yeah. more vegetables, shocker, later in the night when it's like, it's the kitchen sink salad time, when it's just like whatever greens I have in the fridge, throw those in a bowl. And I'm not talking like a little salad bowl. I'm talking like a big old mixing bowl, you know, the big old hunk of ones that meant to serve the family. It's like, nah, that's just mine. We're going to put all the greens in there, and then we're going to take grains. We're going to get some brown rice. We're going to get some quinoa. We're going to get some, I don't know, weird whatever the heck root, you know, grain thing, and we're going to throw that in there. Cool. We got grains. Now let's go get some let's go get some beans. What do we have? We got some cannellini beans. Boom. Put them in. Oh, black beans. Great. Let's throw those in there too. We got some red beans, kidney beans. Boom. Let's throw those in there too. Boom. So now we got like a good amount of beans in there. And then it's like, all right, vegetables. Let's get some vegetables. What do we have roasted in there? Right. So it's like, maybe if I liked what I had for lunch, I'll throw some more in there. If I've got some others that I've already roasted, let's put those in there. Brussels sprouts. Always going to be on there no matter what. Roasted Brussels sprouts in the air fryer, greatest thing ever. Throw those in there. And then instead of going for like a high calorie dressing, we can do like hummus in there. Or, you know, a little pro tip, you can get a really tenderly cooked sweet potato and put that in there instead of like the roasted sweet potato chunks. Like if you've got a baked, really ultra tender potato, sweet potato, you put that in there, and then you kind of use that almost as your dressing to coat that. No fat in there whatsoever. Tons and tons of micros and macros, you know, all the protein you need, and then some. And then some baby carrots and hummus on the side, maybe a little bit of a whole grain pita bread with that. And man, now you're talking. That's just heaven to me. That's just heaven to me.
That's a different life.
Very much so, bro. Very much so.
So I have two more questions for you. One of them is, we talked about improving relationship with food, which we can tell by how you're eating before to how you're eating now, that there's a significant difference. For someone that is currently struggling with a relationship with food, what are pieces of advice that you would share with them, having gone through it and now being on the flip side?
Best thing I can tell you is, number one, I know that when you think that you're going on a diet, it means giving up your favorite foods forever. Doesn't have to be that way. I thought that way even when I was starting out as well. But what it does mean is that your relationship is going to change. You just have to change the recipe for it. So instead of having a, you know, beef grilled stuffed or a cheesy potato burrito from Taco Bell like I used to eat, you know, go for more of the, you know, beans and rice type burrito that you make at home. You have more control over things there. And I do recommend, you know, avoiding the drive-through because temptation, right? Because we all know, even if you get one of those healthier plant-based burritos from Taco Bell, it is not the only thing that's on the menu, my friend. There's a lot of stuff on there that's going to call your name. And if you're there on the wrong day, that willpower is a joke. And you might, you know, order up something that you ordinarily wouldn't. But so just recognizing that whether it's burritos or pizza or hot dogs or whatever the case may be, there are healthier ways to make it. And yeah, I said hot dogs, right? I mean, you'd be amazing the creativity that you can do with just some liquid smoke and some liquid aminos and a little bit of nutritional yeast and a carrot.
Yeah, that's so good.
Dude, the carrot dogs. Like, yeah, they're awesome. Again, call me crazy, but you gotta recognize the credibility of being a former 420-pound guy and knowing some hot dogs. I got you. I'm telling you, it's really good when done properly, right? So
yeah, it's crunchy and it's weird, but yeah, you definitely have to do it right.
It depends. Yeah. Well, it depends on how you do it. You got to steam the carrot so it's soft to the consistency of the hot dog. Nobody's ever had a crunchy hot dog. Do it upright. It's going to take some practice, but once you nail it, you're like, holy sh, you know, like this, that's a legit dog right there, you know, and you can serve it to people. You just put the toppings on it so they don't even recognize. They're not even going to question it. They're like, what is this, an authentic German sausage? Yes, it is. That is legit Wiener Schnitzel, my friend. Yeah. So you don't have to give up your favorite foods. You're just going to change the recipe. But number two, the relationship that you have built up with food over time, it's okay to let that relationship change. You change your friends, you change your clothes, you change a lot of things about yourself over time, all the time. And food can absolutely be the same. And I promise you, life goes on without the seven-layer burritos. Life goes on without the cheesy potato burritos or the beef grilled stuffed burritos or the two pizzas from Papa John's or the stuffed crust from Pizza Hut. Life goes on. And what you remember more than anything isn't so much the food. You know, a lot of it is the memories that come with that food. And so if it's a family recipe that you really liked, or, you know, the family would always on Friday nights order pizza together and watch TV, you know, it's that family time that you remember. It's not the pizza. And so once you recognize that, like, that can make a profound difference too. And then also, if you'll indulge me, give me a second to talk just about cravings, because that's another part of this, especially as you're going through detox, is the cravings will hit. I'm not telling you that they're not. Of course they are.
Yeah.
But what works for me to this day is the recognition that if you just give yourself permission in that time to be uncomfortable and not fight it and wonder what's wrong with me, why is this happening to me? And that in fact, the craving is perfectly normal and you're not a freak show. Somehow it makes the craving a little bit less intense and it knocks it down maybe 10, 15, 20, even as much as 30%. And so while the craving's still there, it's tolerable. So you don't give in. And so I call that just accept the suck. Accept that for that time, your life is going to suck. But once you accept that, it's going to suck a little bit less. So give yourself permission in that time until the craving passes to be uncomfortable, and you're going to be okay. Guaranteed.
Yeah, that's a beautiful piece of advice. I think it ties in with your cookie diet you mentioned earlier. When you start to like feel sick and you weren't feeling that great, if you don't know that it's happening for the sake that you are having cravings and you're addicted to food, you think that something's wrong with your body and you start to like genuinely be concerned. And then you're going to be able to self-justify things even more because you're like, hey, like, I think I'm actually sick and there's something wrong with me. And then you can like lean into the craving ultimately. So I think that's a beautiful thing. It's understanding like you will feel this way and it's okay. You're not sick. You're not going to die. You're going to be okay.
Yep. Yep. That's all it is, man. You're going to be fine. You're perfectly normal. And you've been normal the entire time. That's just it. It's just the way that we're wired, man. There's nothing wrong with you. You're okay.
So last question for you. If you had the opportunity to talk to young Chuck about this whole crazy ride that you've been on up until now, what would you tell him?
Strap yourself in, Junior, because it's going to be one hell of a ride. You are going to achieve things that you never thought were humanly possible. And there are going to be days when you're going to think that you're not going to make it. But brother, I guarantee you are going to dust yourself off. You're going to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. You're going to go out there and you're going to conquer the world and you're going to accomplish the dreams that you had as a little kid. And your dreams are going to change and they're going to become even more rewarding than you ever thought possible. And so just hang in there and never give up hope for yourself. Never give up hope on yourself. When everything seems hopeless, think back to when you were just a little kid. Think back to yesterday, because we're talking to young Chuck, when the teacher asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And know that that's not a BS question. And you can do anything and you can be anything that you want to be. And I don't care if you're 3, 43, 53, or 63, that same thing applies. You can always do what you think is impossible to do. And when you've achieved that, figure out something else that seems impossible and achieve that too. Nothing is off limits, including battling the beast that is an unhealthy diet.
Beautiful words to end on. I want to add to that. I'll say, Chuck, man, massive thank you for taking the time to jump on the podcast. I know you have a really busy schedule, so I appreciate it. Thank you for being so vulnerable and authentic, because I know when I ask uncomfortable questions, so I try to like gauge them, but you were awesome and just being open and sharing. So I know that it resonated with people listening, and I know that it'll continue to help and serve people in the months and years to come. That's the beauty of online. None of this stuff goes away. It'll live on forever. So thank you, brother, for jumping on the show.
It's my pleasure, man. Thank you so much for all the great questions. It's important that we stay authentic because there are a lot of people going through a lot of hurt out there who think that they're absolutely alone, and none of us actually are. So be your true self, and that helps others along the way.
Beautiful. So everyone, thank you very much for listening. I'll link all of Chuck's information down below, his Instagram, the podcast. We have a lot of things going on, so I'll put all the link down below so people can go and support.
Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to rate the podcast as it helps us grow and spread our message. And if you know this will help and resonate with someone, be sure to send it their way so that they can have the opportunity to level up their life as well.